There is an old saying in aviation. Never broadcast your exact arrival time. Keep people guessing. It sounds like paranoia until you know what happened over the jungle of Bougainville on April 18, 1943. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we're talking about a mission so audacious, so calculated, and so cold-blooded that the American government debated whether it was even legal before they said go. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in your flying life. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. By the spring of 1943, he was the most consequential naval officer alive. The Japanese considered him their greatest military mind of the war. He'd spent years in America before the fighting started. He'd studied at Harvard. He'd served as a naval attaché in Washington. He knew the industrial capacity of the United States better than almost anyone in Tokyo, and he had warned his government plainly. A war with America would end in catastrophe. Japan could not sustain it. The factories, the oil, the population, the resolve, Japan would lose. Then he planned Pearl Harbor anyway, because Yamamoto was also a gambler, a bridge player, a chess man, a man who understood odds the way a good instrument pilot understands partial panel. His strategy was simple and brutal, strike so hard and so fast that America would negotiate rather than fight a long war, knock out the Pacific Fleet, demonstrate such devastating force that the will to resist would collapse before the industrial machine could spin up. He was wrong, and he knew within days of the attack that he'd been wrong. He reportedly told a colleague the night after Pearl Harbor that he feared all they had done was awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve. That quote may be apocryphal, but the sentiment was real, Yamamoto understood. He just couldn't stop what he'd set in motion. What Yamamoto did not know was that the sleeping giant had been reading his mail. The American Naval Intelligence Program, known as MAGIC, had cracked Japanese naval communications. Not perfectly, not completely, but well enough to get dangerous. Commander Joe Rochefort and his team at Station Hypo in Hawaii had spent years building the vocabulary and the methods to decode Japanese traffic. They were the same team that had helped Admiral Nimitz understand the Japanese plan at Midway in 42. On April 13, 1943, a decoded message arrived. It was Yamamoto's travel itinerary, complete, precise. Every departure time, every arrival, every waypoint for a scheduled tour of Japanese bases in the Solomon Islands. He would leave Rabaul early in the morning on April 18th. He would arrive at Balale Airfield at 07:45, then Bougainville, then back to Rabaul by afternoon. The message noted the aircraft type, the escort strength, everything. The Americans read it, and then they had to make a decision. Now here's where it gets interesting, and a little uncomfortable. Was it legal to specifically target and kill a named enemy officer? Not in the fog of battle. Not in a bombing raid on a military installation. But hunting a single man, by name, with a specific intercept mission. That question was real in 1943. International law of armed conflict had things to say about it. Even then, some argued there was no moral distinction whatsoever. Kill the enemy wherever you find him. Others were less certain. Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, and Admiral Nimitz both debated it. The question went up the chain to President Roosevelt. Roosevelt's response, as later reported by Knox, was direct. He reportedly said, "Get Yamamoto, that was enough." Major John Mitchell was handed the mission. He had 16 people, 38 Lightnings from the 339th Fighter Squadron operating out of Henderson Field on Guadalcanal. Now, if you know the P-38 Lightning, you know what kind of airplane it was. Lockheed built it under the direction of Hall Hibbard and a young engineer named Kelly Johnson, who would go on to run the Skunk Works and change aviation more than almost anyone who ever lived. The P-38 had two Allison 12-cylinder engines, twin tail booms, a center nacelle for the pilot and armament, and a silhouette unlike anything else in the sky. The Germans called it Der Gebelschwanzteufel, the fork-tailed devil. They respected it because they had to. It was fast, it climbed hard, and it had range that no single engine fighter of the era could match. That range was the whole reason Mitchell had P-38s and not something else. Guadalcanal to the intercept point over Bougainville was over 400 miles each way. 800 miles round trip, in a fighter on a wartime fuel load, at low altitude, where fuel burns faster. The engineering team fitted the airplanes with auxiliary drop tanks to make it work, and even then the fuel margins were tight enough to make a grown man nervous. But range wasn't even the hardest part. Mitchell couldn't fly a direct course. The direct route to Bougainville passed close enough to Japanese radar stations and coast watcher positions that a formation of American fighters heading northwest would be spotted, reported, and Yamamoto's transport would simply divert to another airfield. The mission would be over before it started. So Mitchell planned a detour, south from Guadalcanal, then west, then north, in a long arcing approach that kept the flight over open ocean for the first leg. They would fly at no more than 50 feet above the water, below radar coverage, out of sight of any coast, just 16 airplanes in the Pacific Ocean. And here is the part that genuinely gets me when I think about it. John Mitchell had no navigation aids, no radio fix available at that altitude, no LORAN, no instrument that could tell him where he was over open water. He had a magnetic compass, he had a watch, he had wind data from the weather briefing, and he had math-specific headings, calculated airspeeds, and precise timing for each leg of the approach. He planned to intercept Yamamoto's transport aircraft within seconds of its scheduled arrival time, hundreds of miles from Henderson Field, after a course that bent and turned across open ocean with no landmarks to correct against. If his calculation was wrong by a few minutes, or if the headwind was stronger than forecast, or if anyone in the formation got slightly off speed, the mission was over. Too early and they'd find empty sky. Too late and Yamamoto would be on the ground and untouchable. There was no second chance. The formation departed Henderson Field at 07:25 on the morning of April 18th. 16 airplanes, two flights, a kill flight of four led by Captain Thomas Lanfear Jr. and Lieutenant Rex Barber. A top cover flight of 12 assigned to deal with the Zero escorts. They went down to the surface, some accounts say 50 feet, some say less, over the Coral Sea, then into open ocean, heading into a sun that was still climbing. No land in sight in any direction, just the compass, the watch, and the roar of 32, Allison engines dragging a formation of fork-tailed devils across the Pacific at wavetop height. Mitchell flew the legs, he counted the seconds, he watched the compass card. He made the turns at the calculated times and trusted the numbers. At 09:34, with 9 minutes remaining before the scheduled intercept, the formation spotted land. Bougainville right where it was supposed to be. Mitchell's dead reckoning navigation had been so precise that after nearly 400 miles of open ocean flying, they arrived within 1 minute of their planned position. And then someone called it out, bogies, 11 o'clock high. Two Mitsubishi bombers, the Allies called them Bettys, the G4M, a twin-engine medium bomber that the Japanese used for everything from torpedo attacks to transport. Six Zero fighters flying escort above and behind them. The Bettys were at about 1,500 feet descending toward the coastline of Bougainville, right on schedule. Yamamoto was in the lead aircraft. He was wearing his dress whites, his sword was at his hip. Everything happened very fast. The kill flight pushed the throttles and went for the bombers. The top cover climbed to engage the Zeros. Lanfear and Barber split. Lanfear got tangled up almost immediately with a Zero that cut him off. Barber went after the lead Betty, a tail chase, pushing his P-38 hard to close the distance. What happened in the next 60 seconds has been argued about for the better part of 80 years. Lanfear claimed he turned into the lead Betty in a beam attack and shot it down over the jungle. Barber claimed he closed on it from behind and put rounds into the left engine and left wing route. Post-war analysis of the crash site, of bullet angles through the recovered wreckage, and of the testimony from Japanese witnesses on the ground strongly supports Barber's account. The damage pattern was consistent with a rear attack, not a side attack. The Air Force Historical Division eventually credited Barber with the kill. The argument between Lanfear and Barber continued in print and in person until both men were dead. What is not disputed, the lead Betty went down into the jungle. The second Betty, carrying Yamamoto's staff officers, went into the water off the coast. Lieutenant Ray Hine was shot down and killed during the engagement, the only American loss. The formation turned south for Guadalcanal. Japanese search parties found the wreckage the following day, deep in the jungle. Yamamoto was still in his seat, strapped in, upright, his white-gloved hand rested on the hilt of his sword. He had died from two bullet wounds. He was 60 years old. The architect of Pearl Harbor was gone. Now here's something the history books sometimes gloss over. What did America do with that information? Nothing. Officially, nothing at all. The Navy classified the mission. They kept it buried, because announcing they had killed Yamamoto would tell Japan something far more dangerous than the death of any single officer. It would tell them their communications codes were compromised, and broken Japanese codes were worth more to the Allied war effort than Yamamoto ever could have been. Codebreakers win wars in ways that never make headlines. So the pilots were decorated quietly, without public explanation. The press was told to stay quiet. There were leaks, rumors, whispers, Tokyo Rose hinted at it in broadcasts. American journalists started asking questions. But the full story didn't surface until after the war ended. Japan didn't announce Yamamoto's death for over a month. On May 21, they acknowledged he had died in combat. Emperor Hirohito promoted him posthumously. He was given a state funeral. He became a martyr, which is exactly what his government needed, and exactly what America was trying to avoid handing them. You'll sometimes read that killing Yamamoto changed the outcome of the Pacific War. I think that overstates it. By April of 43, Japan was already losing. Guadalcanal had been evacuated. The attrition of Japanese carrier aviation at Coral Sea and Midway was already irreversible. The industrial gap between the two nations was widening every month. No single admiral could have turned that tide. But it mattered in smaller ways. Yamamoto's successor, Admiral Minichi Koga, was capable enough but not of the same caliber. Japanese strategic planning became less coherent, less aggressive, more reactive, and the morale effect on the Japanese Navy was real. Yamamoto had been something close to untouchable in their minds. When he died, something changed. As for John Mitchell, the man whose navigation made everything possible, he received the Navy Cross quietly, with minimal fanfare. A man who had just accomplished one of the most remarkable feats of aerial dead reckoning in the history of the war, guiding 16 fighters to an exact point in the Pacific and arriving within 60 seconds of a calculated schedule, received a medal and was told not to talk about it. That was the culture. You flew the mission. You did the job. You went back to the flight line. You didn't expect a parade. The P-38s that flew that day are long gone. Henderson Field is an international airport now with scheduled service and a terminal and all the rest of it. The jungle on Bougainville has mostly reclaimed the crash site. Some of the wreckage is said to still be there, underneath the canopy rusting back into the earth. Rex Barber died in 2001, Tom Landfear in 87, John Mitchell in 2006. They were old men by the end, and most of them had made a kind of peace with what they'd done. Some said it troubled them. Some said war is war. Both answers are honest. What stays with me, every time I come back to this story, is Mitchell at the controls of that P-38 over open ocean. No landmarks, no nav aids, nothing but a compass, a watch. And the numbers he'd worked out on a chart the night before, trusting the math, flying the heading, counting the seconds, and arriving exactly where he said he would. Sources for today's segment include Burke Davis's book Get Yamamoto, Gordon Prange's research on Pacific theater operations, and the Air Force Historical Research Agency's published analysis on the kill credit controversy. Good reading if you want to go deeper. You can find us at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Stay ahead of the airplane.